Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Hello, I'm Charlotte Metcalf. Welcome to Radio Oldie. My guest today is the actor and writer Simon Williams, who burst onto our TV screens in 1971 as the impossibly handsome James Bellamy in Upstairs, Downstairs. Simon, who took up the role at the tender age of 25, has gone on to enjoy a long and distinguished career, but still cites Upstairs, Downstairs as his biggest break, if not his only big break. There's an awful lot more to talk about, but given that Upstairs, Downstairs was the series that catapulted Simon into instant fame with a reputation as a major heartthrob, let's begin there. Simon Williams, a very warm welcome to Radio Oldie.
Oh, what a lovely intro. Thank you.
Well, it's absolutely wonderful to have you, as I was absolutely gripped to Upstairs, Downstairs as a teenager. If it aired today, we'd all be binge-watching it. These kind of long-running series are now extremely popular and not so rare, but back then it was absolutely essential viewing. Tell our listeners a bit about how you got the part and what it was like to work on it.
Upstairs, Downstairs was just my lucky day. Everybody has a lucky day somewhere in their early career, I think. And for some reason, I was feeling very flippant on the day of the audition. Every young actor in London was after the role. And for some reason, I think I was in a hurry to get somewhere else, and I kind of was rather haphazard and kind of nonchalant, which is a difficult thing to fake nonchalance in the interview. And I was amazed to get the call from my agent saying they offered you this series. It was then called 165 Eaton Place, and the idea of a series about a lot of servants and the family didn't seem very appealing, and I'd got the offer of a long tour and a play. And I said, I thought maybe I should do that. My agent said, no, I think maybe it's time you did a bit of proper television. And it was quite daunting because my character didn't actually come into the series until episode 3, by which time the staff and the family of 165 Eaton Place had all kind of established a working relationship. And I had to pitch in with a very difficult episode, flirty kind of episode with Pauline Collins, who's, I think, one of the best actresses we've ever had. And it was quite daunting because television then was a kind of like a hybrid between halfway between live theatre, kind of weekly rep, and film. So the cameras would move about and you really couldn't stop. You had to keep going.
Had you done any television before that?
I'd done bits and pieces, but this was this kind of longish looking commitment, and for a fee of £65 a week, it seemed pretty good.
So tell us how you got into acting in the first place, because you come from such a distinguished line of actors, and you're married to an actress, and on. So tell us a bit about your family and your parents.
Well, my father was an actor called Hugh Williams, who was a bit of a matinee idol before the war, and he was in films. He was in Wuthering Heights. He was in David Copperfield. Through my childhood, my most vivid memories of him playing in the West End and commuting. After the war, he went bankrupt and had rather a rough time, and he started writing plays with my mother, most notably plays like The Grass is Greener, The Irregular Verb to Love, Plaintive in a Pretty Hat, and he was always in them himself. And I would go and watch him from the wings, and he'd be wearing his own clothes, speaking the kind of lines he said at home in his drawing room comedies. And it just looked like kind of heaven. I'd watch him putting his makeup on in the dressing room. And I just looked like an easy and wonderful, magical way of earning a living.
What was your first part?
My father said, if you want to be an actor, I'm going to cut you off without a penny. And I said, I don't want to be disrespectful, Pa, but as far as I know, according to the reports from my school friends, you are an undischarged bankrupt. So cutting me off, not very effective. So he said, all right, but I can't afford to send you to drama school. I'd left school at 16, I got a job in weekly rep in Worthing, and it was without doubt the happiest time of my life. everyone knows how weekly rep works. You rehearse a play during the day, you open on Monday, you start the following week's play on the Tuesday, and it just is like a kind of runaway train, and it was just happiness. My actual first part, because I was a sort of a dog's body, a kind of ASM, and sometimes I was on the book, sometimes I was looking for props, sometimes I was allowed to play a small part. My first significant part was in Aladdin, playing the genie of the lamp. And it was, I remember every time he rubbed the lamp, the dame rubbed the lamp, there was a kind of crescendo of drum roll and then a puff of weedy smoke. And I bound on with a turban on my head, stripped to the waist, and then, what are your commands, my master? Happy days. It was very, very intense. And all the direction and all the kind of acting had to be completely spontaneous. There was no kind of, shall we go down this path, shall we go? It was just get up and do it and say it. No, say it better, do it different, wear this, wear that. You had to supply all your own clothes.
No.
Yeah, so it was sort of incumbent. You had to have a blazer and cavalry twills, a casual outfit, and you had to have a suit, and you had to have a dinner jacket. And I remember after about 3 or 4 weeks using the same grey flannel suit, I thought I'd spend the weekend making it into a pinstripe suit. So I got some tailor's chalk and spent the weekend with a ruler making it into a pinstripe. And it did look quite good until I went on stage and the leading man had to embrace me as his, as my father. All the dust came flying out. It was wonderful.
And what of it now? Is there just no such equivalent that goes on?
Well, the little theatres, they have a lot of tribute shows, all those theatres now, tribute shows and stand-up comedy and stuff. But the actual business of a kind of scramble to get a performance together in 5 days has gone. I think if I could replay my early days, and even now, I would try and expunge the image of my father from my acting, because I always, and still do quite often, play parts through a kind of filter of him. I do an impersonation of him playing a part. Certainly when I played James Bellamy in Upstairs, Downstairs, I watched him playing Lord Sir Robert Chiltern in the wonderful film of An Ideal Husband, and it was a sort of impersonation of him.
You grew up with two siblings, but your brother, Hugo, went down a completely different route and has become a very well-known poet. How do you think he escaped the acting gene?
I think he would have been a wonderful movie star. You know, he had a kind of...
he's very handsome.
Very, very handsome and very kind of, very cool. I mean, he could blow smoke rings and raise one eyebrow and do all the things that... And we were great admirers of Dirk Bogarde. He in particular, I think he knew Dirk Bogarde a bit. Prophetically, when he was very little, he was asked what he'd like to do when he grew up. And he said, I'd just like to do living. And I think writing poetry as he does, as brilliantly and meticulously as he does, I think he's pretty much achieved that. I think he liked working alone. I don't think he would have liked the sort of the communal work that acting requires. You know, you have to, it's a very intimate business, acting. It's very, very intimate and intricate, and you get to know people terribly well.
Both Lucy and your daughter Amy, you've worked with both of them, haven't you? How was that?
It's terribly good. I've worked with both my wives quite a lot, and there's something very commendable about working with people who know and love you, because although it's absolutely ghastly to be told that you're overacting or not, haven't quite nailed something, they have got your best interests at heart. And I think especially Lucy is, she's very not ruthless, but she won't let me get away with something that she doesn't believe in when I'm acting. She's a wonderful, wonderful actress, and it's she's got something of her mother. She just transmits what's inside her very subtly.
Can we just mention, of course, who Lucy's mother is, the great Celia Johnson?
Yeah, well, we both had acting parents. Lucy's mum was Celia Johnson, who will remain forever in people's memories as Laura in Brief Encounter. Those eyes and that. She had an incredible gift of spontaneity, both on stage and in film. You could see the thought arriving in her head just before the line came out of her mouth. It never looked as if she was speaking lines.
It's so true, because when I think of that last devastating scene in Brief Encounter, when she's back with the husband, I don't think she says a word, but you know, everything. And of course, tell our listeners a bit about last year when you and Lucy took her letters on tour and did them together.
We've worked together a great deal, and we actually first met doing Hay Fever together back before either of us married our first partners. And shortly after, well, not very shortly after Celia died, Lucy and her sister Kate discovered that they had both kept all the letters they had written to one another.
Between Celia and her husband?
Yes, the wartime letters. He was all over the place in Norway and Greece, and mostly in the Far East. But the letters between them, as we started reading them and unfolding the crinkled airmail paper, and that, you know, these letters were written in the blackout or in a tent somewhere in the Far East, they just were so evocative of the time, and they were newly married, and they just started their wonderful life together, her as an actress, him as a writer. And these letters are heartbreaking in their bravery, the way they try to be funny for each other. The actual war information is quite sparse, because obviously Peter being in deception, he couldn't reveal quite what he was up to. But Celia was extraordinarily interesting about acting and the part she was being offered, this happy breed, and eventually, of course, Brief Encounter. Wonderful, funny letters, brave letters, sexy and romantic, darling letters.
Oh, wonderful. Tell us a bit about acting with Amy, because that was in a play you wrote, and we want to get on to your writing, because that's what you do. That's what you love doing now, isn't it?
I love acting, but I'm very glad that diversity has kind of buffeted the waves a bit, because for years I've been sort of slightly pigeonholed and typecast, whatever you want to call it. And so in a way I've got quite bored of doing and watching my work. And I wrote a play with a part for a young daughter, a rom-com. The director said, Andy Lalator said, haven't you got a daughter who's just left drama school? And I said, yeah, Amy. And he said, but you've got a daughter in the play, and it must be based on your daughter. I said, well, yes, I suppose it is. And so he said, well, let's have her in. And she was just wonderful in the part. She was playing the grumpy teenager, and I was playing the kind of... One of my early gods was Richard Briers as an actor. He was a fabulous actor. He had a speed and intuition for comedy. And, I was kind of trying to be him, I think, in the play. I've worked quite a lot with my boy Tam, who's... we did a long tour of Tartuffe together, so I've worked with them both. And they both work with their mothers. We're just riddled with theatre. We can't escape it. and now my grandchildren are having a go.
Let's talk a bit about some of the actors you work with, because you mentioned Richard Briers just then. But also thought, you said somewhere that Michael Crawford was one of the most funny men you'd ever, ever come across in your life.
I think he's nearly a comic genius. I mean, I didn't know Sex Please were British with him in the West End for 18 months. And his understanding of comedy and of what gets an audience was quite extraordinary. He was a proper clown. He could swing from pathos to high comedy. His timing was just so brave, and I've never heard laughter like it. Any other comic genius? I did two films with Peter Sellers.
Yes.
And on a good day, he was magical. On a bad day, he was hell on earth.
In what way?
He's just temperamentally, he'd just suddenly rip off his wig and say, no, I can't do it today, I'm going.
Oh.
Or we'd all have to go and smoke a joint or have a jab of vitamin B12 or have a day off. It was chaos.
What were the two films you did with Peter Sellers?
The three last films he did, I was in the two flops either side of being there. The first one was The Prisoner of Zenda, and he played the two roles. And the last one he did, the last film we did was called The Fiendish Plot of Dr. Fu Manchu. But he even in life, you never quite knew who he was. You go into the makeup room and some days he'd be very kind of sounding like a toff, and other days he'd be a bit Yorkshire and a bit cockney and cheery. He was, I don't think he really knew who he was, but his happiest memories were of doing the Goons, and he would reminisce about doing the Goons.
That's a very good little segue into radio, because, of course, you are the absolute cad, Justin Elliott in The Archers. Is that fun?
It's rather stinking to have started my mediocre career playing a cad, and I'm sort of ending up playing a cad upstairs, downstairs to Ambridge. It's very difficult playing people who you don't terribly like, because you're a bit like a barrister trying to defend someone who you suspect might be actually guilty. So you always try to make these characters as human as possible, to give cold characters a bit of warmth, to give bastards some kind of motive for some kind of reason for being unpleasant. The only good thing about playing sort of slightly horrible people is that you don't have to do much when you meet people in real life to make a good impression, because in real life I'm really quite genial, I hope. It's a very weird business, radio. It's extraordinary, because I think The Archers is kind of brilliant. When you listen to a scene of people walking through a field or a meadow or cooking or doing whatever, or walking down, you really absolutely believe it. It's the most wonderful form of drama. And the actors in it, they're just completely convincing to me.
Yes, I agree with you. I mean, I'm a complete... You know, it's what I've listened to The Archers all my life. I mean, I really have. It's pathetic.
Was your mother a listener?
Yes, yes.
Most avid listeners started on my mother's knee. It used to be an absolute ritual in my father's dressing room. I'd go and watch him getting made up, and the half an hour call would go, and he'd have a whiskey and a Cravenet, and then there'd be silence as he put his makeup on and listened to The Archers.
But tell us a bit about who writes it, because you say, you know, that it's exhausting having to play a cad all the time, but he does have occasional moments that redeem him.
I've had my nice moments. I liked working in the shop with John Lloyd. I did that for a spell. And every now and then, you know, they give you a nice storyline.
Yes. And,
I rather like the Scrooge story we had before Christmas, when Justin had a kind of epiphany and he was being very nice.
Yes.
I think he's reverting to type now, I'm afraid. I think he's. I'm not sure if he's beside all the sewage problem we've got at the moment in Ambridge. I keep waiting to see a script and see if I'm going to be the culprit.
They don't tell you in advance, no.
No, absolutely, under lock and key. We never get a storyline. We wait, like footballers on the bench, we wait to see if we're going to be needed next week or next month. We have a sort of floating cast of about 30-odd actors, and there's only ever six in an episode. So if you haven't got a storyline, you're kind of on the bench.
So let's just talk about other actors for a minute, because you've also said that your Nigel Havers, who, of course, married your late sister... Mm. Polly, you loved acting with him, didn't you?
I did. We did the series Don't Wait Up together, and we had a wonderful, wonderful time and became great friends, so much so that he and my sister got together.
Did you introduce them?
Yeah, and so it was a tricky time, because they were both married to other people, and there was a bit of unravelling to be done there before they got together. And it was a tricky kind of marriage, because I think anything like that on the back of two other marriages is always difficult territory with children and stuff like that. But he was a wonderful, wonderful nurse and companion to her through her wretched journey down the cancer path.
Mm.
He was wonderful, cooking for her, looking after her, keeping her spirits up. So I'll always love him for that.
Now, what about your writing, Simon? Because that's what you're really focusing on now, isn't it?
It's very empowering to become a writer, having been an actor, because as an actor, you really are the slave of the writer. You have to follow his rhythm, his choice of words, you know. I mean, sometimes you just think, half your brain as an actor is saying, don't make me say that. It just isn't right. It's not grammatically right. It's got no lyric. It doesn't sound the way I want the character to sound. And so that battle can go on in your head. And so the freedom of actually writing dialogue yourself means you, everything has a kind of, you feel you own it. I love words. I love, you know, so many great writers about. I mean, I'm not in their league, but just trying to record the undercurrent of what people mean, because acting is about saying one thing and meaning another, and to find that in dialogue and to achieve it is quite a task. It's not easy.
Is the trick to get the right actors as well? Because you were very pleased when Jenny Seagrove and Martin Shaw did a play of yours.
They were lovely. It's when two really good players get hold of what you're trying to say and make it come alive. It was wonderfully directed too by Sean Mathias. It was just great.
What was the play? What was it called?
It was called Alone Together. It was a touching little play, and I hope it's got a future life. Sadly, the wonderful producer, Bill Kenwright, who put it on, upped and died. So it's slightly gone into hiatus, but with any luck, we'll see it again. I know Jenny's very keen to do it again.
And are you writing the ultimate part for yourself?
Yes, but... When I wrote a play that I did with Stephanie Beecham, she would say, some nights, she'd say, you weren't there tonight. You were the writer watching the play going round you. And I absolutely know what she meant. You were thinking, no, I can rewrite that line better, and it would be better if we were the other. You know, you're always trying to improve the play rather than playing the character. And so it's quite tricky saying your own dialogue. I wish my father was still alive to tell me how he managed it, because he did that for 15 or 20 years, the last 20 years of his life, he's spoke mostly his own lines in his own plays, you know.
I read somewhere that someone asked you, you know, what actor you'd like to have been. And you said Jeremy Irons, which I thought was really surprising. Why Jeremy Irons?
Well, he's a great friend. And I think what I actually meant was whose salary would I most like to have?
Oh, that's different.
He's had a great deal of success. Yeah. I think I couldn't top him. He's a great actor, but whose career would I like to have had? I don't know. I'd just like to be me. I think this is an interesting point about acting. I think an actor is lucky if he's born looking like the person he is inside. I look like someone who should be sort of vaguely Roger Moore-y, kind of symmetrically faced and vaguely heroic. And inside, I'm David Jason. I've got to battle against that. I mean, I always, as a person, as a writer and as an actor, I'm always tempted to suddenly put my tongue in my cheek and say, oh, I didn't really mean it.
What part do you still look at and think, oh, I'd really like to play that?
Oh, I don't know. I, being as so British as I am, I wish I could have played some of the Russians. You know, would have loved to have done, I don't know, the Cherry Orchard or the Seagull. I'd love to have had a go at Richard II years ago. I've been stuck. I mean, most of my theatre work has been leaning on a mantelpiece in a drawing room comedy and bursting on through French windows. the boring thing about being a sort of toff actor is that most of the parts I play are certainly on television, playing sort of consultants, lawyers, specialists in areas, and they impart information. And while you're learning all this gobbledygook to speak as a consultant or a barrister, the camera is always on the person who's hearing the news, or lying in the hospital bed, or standing in the, you know, in the dock accused of murder, and so that's fairly thankless, and it's hell to learn. Learning information is always difficult. Actors want to be soul-searching and revealing themselves.
But you say, it's interesting, you say Richard II, but you've all, I also read somewhere that you haven't particularly wanted to run after, you know, a Hamlet or a Lear or any of the other enormous, meaty Shakespearean roles.
Oh, gosh, you've done your homework, which is always wretched because it means I'm going to contradict myself all along the way. I would love to have played all those parts, but I think what I've always dreamed of is Alan Ayckbourn calling up and saying, listen, old boy, I've got a wonderful new play I'd like you to be in, or Stop On, or David Hare. You know, a new play is really, really thrilling.
Out of every part you've played, what's been your favourite, do you think? I mean, apart from being in Rep in Worthing.
Yeah. What's been my favourite part? I suppose I have to put poor old Major Bellamy fairly high there, because I look back on him and there's been a little steady income flow over the 50 years since I started there. It was slightly extraordinary. After the suicide episode, when he was killed off at the end, I felt an incredible feeling of release and relief that he was gone. I'd been carrying this miserable, poor, privileged person around like a dead weight on my back for all these years. So I was very involved with him. I'm not sure if he's my favourite character. I loved working with Maureen Lipman on Agony. That was quite a good part. And on the stage, I've loved the two Rattigan plays I've done. I did The Winslow Boy, and I love playing the barrister in that. And The Deep Blue Sea I did with Greta Scacchi. Rattigan, a great, great understanding of the human heart. And he also knew, almost better than any other of those writers of the time, how little an actor needed to do a lot with. He never overwrote, so the economy of his writing left the actor with so many options. He was just great.
Mm-hmm. So what next?
Well, Lucy and I do this programme, Posting Letters to the Moon, which we've got quite a lot of gigs for around various festivals and little theatres and things, which we love doing. And we've got The Archers to do. And I do a little bit of public speaking, sort of groups of people who've got nothing better to do, telling them about my life and times, telling a few anecdotes that Charles Brandreth hasn't already told them somewhere else. I hope that Harry Mark will continue to give me the odd corner of his wonderful magazine to write something for.
Well, you write wonderfully, and you've written about people you've had encounters with, like, you know, Wilfred Hyde White, for example.
Wilfred Hyde White. He was a rascal. There was a wonderful kind of raft of actors around that who were all like sort of godfathers or uncles to me. And they were Robert Morley, David Tomlinson, Wilfred Hyde White. They were very casual about it. And I maybe grew up just thinking that acting was that easy. You know, they just ambled on stage. And, you know, Wilfred Hyde White was sitting downstage in a drawing room comedy, which wasn't going too well. And he leant forward and said to a woman in the front row, "It's not very good, is it?" He was just so casual.
But was he a rascal? I love the rascal, because you associate him with the ultimate sort of benign, yes, silver-haired, yes, lovely, lovely, godfathery figure.
He was quite naughty, though. He was quite naughty. He would have it in his contract that he wouldn't play matinees during Goodwood or Ascot. He would have the matinee off. And, he was quite mystical, too. He was quite sort of mystical. He never put makeup on, but he'd sit there at his dressing table, and I'd go and talk to him before the show. And he'd had all these little tiny animals on his desk, and he'd be talking to them all and sort of stroking them and touching them. And then one day he said to me, "Make me a promise." And I said, "What?" And he said, "Never wear green. I see you're wearing green, Charlotte." And he said, "Never wear green." And I said, "Well, why not?" And he said, "Just believe me, don't wear green." And I never have. He said it was unlucky. And funny enough, and so did Peter Sellers. He had a thing about green. I love all the superstitions of actors. I love actors. If you said I had to stop acting because I was been found out and was no good, I'd say, "Well, please just let me go on meeting actors and mixing with actors. They're just the most wonderful, stimulating people to be with."
But you're absolutely surrounded by them. I mean, is there anybody in your family who is not an actor?
No, I don't think many of us are working at the moment. No, I think my first mother-in-law, she came from five generations of theatre. Lucy's mother was an actress. Most of my children are actors. My stepson is a movie producer. We can't escape from it. I mean, why would you? Why would you want to go into hedge fund management or, I don't know.
No.
Dressing up and shouting in the evening. That's the way to live.
Well, what a wonderful, wonderful note to end on. Simon Williams, thank you so much for being on Radio Oldie. We loved having you.
Oh, I'm so sorry. It's over.
You've been listening to me, Charlotte Metcalf, in conversation with the actor and writer Simon Williams on Radio Oldie, brought to you by Baillie Gifford. If you've enjoyed listening to us and would like to hear more conversations like this, please go to www.theoldie.com. co.uk, where you'll find plenty more and also be able to subscribe to the magazine. My very warm thanks again to Simon Williams, to Baillie Gifford for sponsoring us, and to you for listening. Goodbye. You've been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Baillie Gifford. Why not get three trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every six issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.